Last time we spoke about the Allied offensive against Mubo and the naval battle of Kolombangara. The Australians and Americans were continuing their drive towards Salamaua and Leh, but in their way was the once heavily fortified area of Mubo. Because of the intricate diversionary attacks in multiple places, the Japanese gradually lifted their defensive positions in Mubo until the time was ripe for the Allies to seize it. The Pimple, Green Hill, and Observation Hill, places that had caused tremendous suffering and hardship, were finally seized. Mubo was secured. And over in the Solomons, the New Georgia campaign was continuing, forcing the Japanese to make another daring Tokyo Express run like they did at the Battle of Kule Gulf. Yet again, Admiral Ainsworth went out to face the enemy, completely ignorant of their torpedo capabilities, and he paid dearly for it. Today we are going to continue those stories. This episode is The Drive on Munda Point. Welcome to the Pacific War Podcast week by week, and I'm your dutiful host, Craig Watson. But before we can begin, I just want to remind you all that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Perhaps you want to learn a bit more about World War II? Kings and Generals has an assortment of episodes on World War II and so much more, so go give them a look over at YouTube. So please, subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, The Fall and Rise of China Podcast, written and narrated by me. And if after all that you are still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. Looking for something different? Maybe you're an anime fan. Why don't you check out my review of Grave of the Fireflies. Also, just a friendly reminder, I myself have a Patreon account, which can be found at www.patreon.com/thepacificwarchannel. Over there, you can find exclusive podcasts, like my four-part series on General Kanji Ishiwara, the mastermind behind the Mukden Incident, and the author behind the Final War Theory. Check it out, it would mean a lot to me. Today we are starting with the main drive towards Munda. We are picking up from last time, where General Wing had finally begun his main advance on Munda on July the 9th. Now the landings had occurred on July the 2nd. From then on, the Americans were busy making other landings, such as the one at Rice Anchorage, getting forces to assembly points and trying to hinder any efforts by the Japanese to reinforce Munda. If you were looking down upon a map, it would basically look like multiple forces taking up positions that cut off trails and ports that extend towards Munda. Everyone had a unique task and a timetable, but as we all know, not everything goes according to plan. When General Wing ordered the main advance, two infantry regiments were greatly delayed, those being the 172nd, who moved a grand total of 1,100 yards, and the 169th, who made zero ground at all. The war planners had not considered how difficult it would be for ground forces to travel the single narrow tracks, the dense jungles, the mangroves, the creeks, the ridges, and the ravines. The men found navigation difficult, and whenever the terrain seemed to narrow, they found Japanese defenders. The 172nd were ordered by Major General Hester to carry out flanking maneuvers against a roadblock set up by the 9th Company 3rd Battalion 229th Regiment, while the 169th attacked them frontally. They were supported by heavy artillery, naval bombardment, and aerial bombing. But General Sasaki correctly predicted the American commander's intentions and responded to them rather quickly with his own counter-flanking maneuvers. His forward area was held by Japanese snipers, well concealed in baskets in trees, who employed rifles that gave little to no muzzle flashes, something that was turning into a real trait for the Japanese. The 172nd progressed a few hundred yards with its 1st Battalion leading the way, the 2nd behind them, and the 3rd following from quite a distance. They were assaulting a point where the Munda Trail intersected another trail running southwest to a beach, and southeast of this were the native villages of Ilangana and Liana. The Japanese managed to keep them 1,500 yards away from the defenses. The artillery was not working to dislodge the Japanese from the roadblock, and during the night the Japanese were reinforced with some units of the 11th Company, who took up some high ground, later called Renkei. This made things ever worse for the inexperienced and pretty brutally shaken 169th, who had the unfortunate job of meeting them in a frontal assault. Things were becoming even worse for General Wing. Despite the slow progress, the American forces had actually overstretched their logistics by July the 10th. The 118th Engineer Battalion had been making some good progress building up a jeep trail going from Zazana to the Baraque River. They relied on information provided by Native scouts, and the engineers built the trail over high, dry ground, averaging around half a mile or so per day. But the 5-foot-deep, fast-running stream east of the Baraque caused a ton of soft mud, not very engineer-friendly. To get the ground firm enough for footbridges and such, they were forced to swing the road northward parallel to the river for over 2 miles. This gap between the end and the front of the road meant nearly half of the combat troops were forced to carry forward ammunition, food, water, and other supplies. And let us not forget, everyone who was getting sick or wounded needed to be carried back on the same roadways. Again, logistics are not as sexy as the combat, and don't usually get much time of day. But it's important for any war effort. Hell, look at Russia today. To solve his logistical headache, General Hester decided to divert the 172nd Infantry Regiment south towards Lyana, while the 169th would continue their miserable work advancing up the Munda Trail. Now, Lyana was just 500 yards east of the main Japanese defensive line at Iligana, currently being held by the 2nd and 3rd Battalions of the 229th Regiment and the 2nd Independent Quick Firing Battalion, all under the command of Colonel Hirata Genjiro. The 172nd would have the support of the 3rd Battalion, 103rd Regiment, and 8 M3 Stuart tanks of the 9th Defense Battalion, who were expected to land at Lyana by July the 13th. On the morning of the 11th, the 172nd began turning south, wading through some knee-deep mud and having the Japanese fire mortars upon them. By midway, they had advanced 450 yards when they came across some Japanese pillboxes. While this was going on, the 169th were pushing against the Japanese upon some high ground, leading to a stalemate. Because of all of this, Colonel Temple Holland replaced Colonel Eisen as commander of the 169th, and Colonel Frederick Ranke took command of the 3rd Battalion, which was being led at that time by Major William Stebbins. On July the 12th, Colonel Holland began a plan calling for the 1st Battalion to attack frontally, while the 2nd Battalion enveloped the Japanese left flank. The 3rd Battalion, who were in reserve, were released to engage the enemy, but the entire thing bogged down immediately as units became intermingled with the 172nd, who were on their way over to Lyana. Meanwhile, Rear Admiral Aaron Merrill with Task Force 36 was ordered to depart Iron Bottom Sound to head over to the Blanche Channel to provide naval bombardment in coordination with the heavy artillery in Rendova and aerial bombing from the aerosols. Merrill took 4 light cruisers, Columbia, Cleveland, Denver, and Multiplier, into the narrow channel while his 2 destroyers, Fahrenholt and Buchanan, took up a position near the Munda Bar to shell the Kokangolo Hill area. Merrill's force fired 8,600 shells for over 40 minutes, which did clear the jungle in front of the advancing troops, but ultimately did little else as they were forced to fire a mile in front of the American positions, but within that mile were the said Japanese defenses. As you can imagine, the boys on the ground were all too excited to now advance, only to find the same unhampered enemy facing them. The 1st Battalion, 169th Regiment, managed to gain about 300 yards. The 2nd Battalion received enfilading fire from a ridge to the north, unable to progress, and the 3rd Battalion assaulted the southern ridge for several hours, enjoying some artillery and aerial support. Over to the south, 172nd were stuck in front of some pillboxes. These pillboxes were not made out of concrete, but instead coconut logs and coral. Pretty ingenious stuff. They ranged from 10 to 12 square feet, with 3 to 4 layers of logs banked with 6 to 8 feet of weathered coral. Their ceilings were usually around 10 feet from the floor, dug into the earth so that 2 to 4 feet of the pillbox projected above the ground. Each had several firing slits for the riflemen or machine gun crews. Outside the pillboxes were foxholes and trenches connecting all positions. All of this was very well camouflaged, using earth, grass, vines, palm fronds, and such, leading Americans to stumble onto pillboxes without even noticing it. One remark made by the 43rd Division after coming across them was that they had an easier time smelling them than seeing them. So if you ever watched classic Pacific War films or the Pacific series on HBO, for example, and wondered how some of these pillboxes were made, Well, there you go. On the morning of the 13th, Colonel Holland requested some aerial support, and he got some at 10 a.m. 12 Dauntless dropped 1,000-pound daisy cutters upon some smoke markers laid out by the 169th. The dive bombers managed to hit the target perfectly before Holland ordered the men to charge in. The 2nd Battalion went through the center, while the 1st Battalion took the right and the 3rd Battalion took the left. They hit the north and south ridges trying to envelop the Japanese. E and F companies of the 2nd Battalion ran into some heavy machine gun fire, causing a halt. The 1st Battalion tried to climb the north ridge, but they were obstructed by a ton of felled trees and craters due to the bombing. The Japanese, who survived the bombardments, opened fire from their pillboxes, keeping the Americans in check. The charging Americans, now without artillery or mortar support, tried to push forward with rifles and bayonet, seeing many killed upon the crest or wounded. Company B would lose 3 out of its 4 officers alone. The 3rd Battalion, now led by Colonel Renke, fought for some hours, managing to progress 500 yards into the Japanese lines, securing the southern ridge. They fought pillbox through pillbox. It was a terribly bloody affair, resulting in 100 casualties. When they took the ridge, they held the position, beating back several counterattacks during the night, to which the men then named the ridge Renke. Soon the 1st and 2nd Battalions took up positions on the 3rd's flanks, securing Renke Ridge, while the Japanese concentrated on the northern ridge, and to the west they held some higher ground called Horseshoe Hill. Meanwhile, the 172nd had their lines of communication cut off to their rear by the Japanese, forcing them to quicken up the pace as they were running low on food. They made it to Liana Beach in the late afternoon, successfully securing the beach and organizing defensive positions rather quickly. The following morning, General Hester landed the 3rd Battalion, 103rd Regiment, and the tanks to back them up at Liana. This came also with some much-needed supplies for the worn-out men. Having supplied the men to the southern beach, now the men in the northern front required resupply as well. Renke's men were tossing back more and more counterattacks. One morning, Japanese artillery fired upon the ridge, bursting a tree that killed 4 men and wounded 23. Alongside this, 5 men were reported to have a case of shell shock, and 7 others wore neurosis. Machine gun fire claimed 2 men, wounded another 5. At 8 p.m., artillery began again, killing another 8 men and wounding 26. There were no medical officers with the battalion, leaving medics to do what they could. Despite the hardship, the 3rd Battalion held their ground, and gradually the Japanese evacuated the northern ridge, which the 2nd Battalion quickly seized. Engineers also finished a bridge going over the Baraki River on the 12th, and on the 14th, it extended the trail within 500 yards of the 169th's front lines. Supply lines were finally being secured, and more importantly, the wounded would be able to be safely transported back down them. By July the 17th, the 43rd Division had 90 deaths, 636 wounded in action, and over 1,000 cases of sickness ranging from the ever-present friend malaria, but also diarrhea, dysentery, and such. As mentioned, cases of psychological problems were also very apparent. Half of the 43rd Division were suffering from war neurosis, which today we call combat stress reaction, CSR. This is an acute reaction from the stress of war that causes the combatant to feel fatigued, have slower reactions, be indecisive, and can become quite disconnected from one's surroundings. If you've ever heard of the 1,000-yard stare, this is that kind of situation. It's classic psychological trauma, kind of similar to what I assume many of you listeners would think of as PTSD, but it is not the same thing. PTSD can see durations lasting months, if not even years, while CSR has a short duration. Small tidbit of information, since my first degree is in neuroscience, by the way, a fairly recent study in the later 2000s was done to look at the issue of CSR, shell shock, and other things from a neurological point of view. The idea was to figure out if a specific physical damage was being done to parts of the brain during blast trauma, for example, that caused combat stress reactions. The reason the study was done was because the symptoms from such maladies often overlapped with things you would see in traumatic brain injuries. Anyways, it was just some interesting reading I did back in my uni days. As pointed out by historian Samuel Eliot Morrison, it seemed General Hester's choice of sending the 172nd Infantry Regiment south had greatly exposed the inexperienced 169th. In his words, "This was perhaps the worst blunder in the most unintelligently waged land campaign of the Pacific War, with the possible exception of Okinawa. The Anna should have been chosen as the initial beachhead. If it was now required, the 172nd should have been withdrawn from Zazana and landed at Liana under naval gunfire and air support. Or Hester might have made the landing with his reserves then waiting at Rendova. As it was, General Sasaki interpreted the move correctly and by nightfall had brought both advances to a standstill." In order to break the deadlock that was occurring, some of the command structure would be reorganized. This coincided with half of the 43rd Division being knocked out from commission, prompting General Hester to request reinforcements for the drive against Munda. General Harmon performed an inspection of the situation and he reported back to Admiral Halsey on Guadalcanal. He advised sending forward General Oscar Griswold of the 14th Corps with a forward echelon of staff so that he could begin building up the administrative supply and planning for the future New Georgia Occupational Force. Once Munda fell, this would allow General Hester to carry on against Villa. Harmon justified this by stating Hester's force was too small to do it, but there was another rationale. By doing this, it would relegate Admiral Turner to a supporting role, whom the Army and Marines were resenting because of what they deemed to be his meddling of ground operations. Admiral Turner opposed the idea, and Halsey replied to Harmon he could simply increase Hester's staff. This prompted Harmon to fly back to Compsopac HQ on Noumea to personally talk to Halsey and force the issue. Griswold showed up at midnight on the 15th, assuming command of the occupational force, leaving Hester to focus on the actions of the 43rd Division's offensive. Griswold began his new task by directing Major General Robert Baitler and the rest of the 37th Division over to New Georgia alongside Colonel Collins' 161st Regiment and his 25th Division. Over at Zenana, the 1st Battalion of the 145th Regiment arrived at 5 p.m., which Colonel Holland tossed up to help reinforce the 169th. Now that Admiral Turner was relieved as commander of the South Pacific Amphibious Force, his new orders were to take up command in the Central Pacific offensives, replacing Admiral Wilkinson. Now General Hester was preparing for a corps-level offensive, but it would take over 10 days to build up, and in the meantime, the Japanese began to prepare a major counteroffensive. On July the 16th and 17th, some small attacks were performed against the Iligana Line, supported now by the newly arrived tanks, but a lack of coordination between the 172nd Regiment's infantry and tanks led to a bit of lack of progress. Nonetheless, the tanks did help against the pillboxes. The tanks took up a wedge formation and used their 37mm guns with high explosive shells to dislodge the panicking Japanese trying to fight back with their machine guns. However, the Japanese were only fazed by the arrival of the tanks for about a day, as on January the 18th, they started to employ anti-tank strategies to great effect. The Japanese defenders began tossing a mixture of mines, Molotov cocktails, and flamethrowers, forcing Griswold to withdraw the remaining tanks and ordered the transportation of the 10th Defense Battalion's tanks to reinforce them. Meanwhile, the 169th Regiment were advancing southwest towards Kelly Hill, located 400 yards southwest of Renki Ridge. They faced little opposition, but they would soon see wave after wave of Japanese counterattacks trying to dislodge them. Over on the other side, the 1st and 3rd Battalions of Colonel Tominati's 13th Regiment had arrived at the scene and they managed to bypass Colonel Liveredge's roadblock. General Sasaki planned to toss Tominari around the Americans' right flank near the East Bridge over the Barake River. From there, they could advance upon Zenana Beach. By July the 14th, the 13th Regiment were marching towards the upper Barake, but the men lacked maps and they were hacking their own trail. Tominari said of this, "If we had to go round and round in circles in the jungle, not having been able to find the enemy, nor having been able to help the 229th Regiment and let them die, it would really hurt the reputation of the 13th Infantry Regiment had for a long time, since the Sino and Russo-Japan War. That was why most soldiers were feeling the pressure. Finally meeting the enemy at that point was like meeting Buddha in hell." It would take them days to march through the thick jungle. On the night of the 17th, Tominari and the men found a jeep trail heading towards General Hester's HQ on Zenana Beach. He ordered his men to attack the area, which at this time was being guarded by a platoon of the 43rd Reconnaissance Troops and 70 Fijian commandos led by Captain David Williams. General Hester was not at the HQ at this time, he was at Liana, but Generals Wing and Barker were. The Japanese launched simultaneous raids against the engineer and medical bivouacs and the 43rd Divisional Command Post. At the same time, Captain Kojima of the 229th Regiment launched an attack against Kelly Hill on the 18th. At 10 a.m., Japanese machine guns north of Kelly opened fire as riflemen charged the western slope. The 1st Battalion fired upon the charging Japanese as the 3rd Battalion fired upon the machine gunners to the north. The Japanese assault was threatening to break the line. Many of the Japanese managed to crawl within grenade-tossing distance of the northern line of the 1st Battalion, but mortar fire forced them back. It was an extremely bloody attack, and the 1st Battalion reported finding 102 dead Japanese upon the slopes at daybreak. Another pre-dawn attack was launched by the 2nd Battalion 229th Infantry against the 3rd Battalion 103rd Infantry, but it was also repulsed. The attacks were done to prevent the American troops from helping the men over at Zenana. If all went well, Sasaki could destroy the 43rd Division's rear installations, cutting off major lines of communications to the surrounding frontline forces. Tominari's raids, however, were quite chaotic and disorderly. Rather than an organized assault, it fell into a series of separate smaller raids, allowing the very few reconnaissance and Fijian commando units to fend off the invaders. The reconnaissance forces repelled the attacks upon the engineer and medical bivouacs, while the Fijian commandos manned a perimeter alongside headquarters personnel, such as drivers, medical orderlies, clerks. Everyone grabbed a rifle, despite not even knowing how to use it, maybe only having basic training under their belt. The Fijians had better eyesight at night than anyone else, and they showcased their abilities to the Japanese, who were certainly not used to being contested in that field of expertise. Taffa, a Tongan, was firing from his foxhole when a Japanese officer wielding a katana and a grenade in the other hand charged at him. Taffa used his own gun to mow down the man, killing him. The Japanese officer was later found to be carrying documents showcasing the full strength of the Japanese forces and details of their mission. The Japanese were screaming as they charged from all directions as the close-quarters melee raged on. The Japanese managed to infiltrate the perimeter multiple times, destroying communications equipment, but they could not reach the most important part of the area, General Barker's artillery. Barker unleashed a tight box barrage from extremely close range to devastating effect. The Japanese had no other option than to flee up the jeep trail from whence they came. Tominari had his surviving forces erect some roadblocks for the next 3 days, but Sasaki's hopes of knocking out the 43rd Division's HQ were all but thwarted. Having survived the major counteroffensive, the 148th Regiment were quickly landed at Zenana, and on the 18th, they were soon sent over to Renki Ridge to relieve the poor 169th Regiment. Colonel Stuart Baxter of the 148th Regiment was surprised by the roadblocks, as Griswold never warned him about them. His advance parties were ambushed, leading to 2 deaths and some wounded. During the night, the Japanese were found drunk off looted whiskey they had taken from the rations dump near the bridge at Barakay. There was a clash where a platoon from the 169th were bringing wounded men down. The drunk Japanese managed to kill many of the wounded men, being carried on litters alongside 2 medics. The bridge henceforth was called Butcher's Bridge. The next morning at 8 a.m., Baxter sent his 1st Battalion and his HQ up the jeep road to fight the Japanese, but as they went up it seemed the Japanese had withdrawn. Baxter's men crossed the East Bridge without incident, but as they went further up the road, suddenly Japanese machine guns opened up on them. One company lost over a dozen men to this ambush, and soon the Japanese were attacking his flanks, forcing Baxter to dig in. By July the 21st, the Japanese would finally depart the area, allowing the 148th Regiment to relieve the 169th. As for the 169th, they were sent over to Rendova, and General Beitler took command of the 37th Division, whom he reshuffled for a new offensive. A 1,300-yard line was formed north of Iligana, with Hester's 43rd Division to the south and Beitler's 37th Division to the north. By this point, Hester moved his 43rd Division command post from Zenana to Liana, where many trails were being created to help with the supply lines. Griswold now planned to start an offensive on July the 25th, opening up with a naval, artillery, and aerial bombardment, before infantry and tanks performed a frontal assault upon the Japanese lines. The 43rd Division would hit from the left to take Lambetti Plantation and its airfield, while the 37th Division would hit from the right against Bibilo Hill, thus enveloping the Japanese north of the airfield. Meanwhile, Colonel Curran's 4th Raiders had secured Inugai Inlet, allowing Liver's Edge to launch his attack against Beiroko. For the attack on Beiroko, Liver's Edge planned to use the 1st and 4th Raiders along the Inugai-Beiroko Trail to hit the Japanese frontally, while the 3rd Battalion with the 148th Regiment would take the Triri-Beiroko Trail to hit their southern flank. Liver's Edge appeared to have expected aerial bombing support, but did not request or failed to request the air support in time. On the morning of the 20th, the forces began their advance. At 10 a.m., Colonel Griffin's 1st Raiders ran into some Japanese outposts manned by just a handful of Japanese. They fired upon them, sending them fleeing. As they continued their advance, they soon came across a much larger force. Eventually, they were forced to halt as they came upon the Japanese main defensive line at around noon. Commander Okimura Saburo had created 4 successive lines of mutually supporting pillboxes on low parallel ridges running north to south. Meanwhile, the 4th Raiders advanced within 300 yards short of the shore of the Beiroko Harbor, meeting the Japanese lines of defense. At 2:30 p.m., Griffin's D Company managed to break into the first line of defense, but an hour later, Okimura ordered heavy mortar fire from the ridges, pushing the Americans back and turning the area into a killing field. The 1st Raiders were unable to move forward, now resting their hopes on the 4th Raiders making a breakthrough in the south. The 4th Raiders ran into the Japanese main line during the midday and were not making any progress. Liver's Edge called the forces at the front and consequently ordered the 2 Raider battalions to take up defensive positions further east on some high ground. The Raiders had suffered 200 casualties before they retired to the south shores of Lilan Lagoon. The next day, reinforcements came over from Inugai, along with some air support. At 9:50 a.m., 24 Dauntless, 25 Avengers, and 8 B-25 swooped in to bomb Beiroko. This was followed up at noon by 37 Avengers, 6 B-25s, and then at 4 p.m., 48 Dauntless and 25 other Avengers. 130 tons of bombs hit Beiroko, alongside an estimated 24,000 rounds of machine gun bullets. Liver's Edge ordered the men to sit tight and hold their positions, for now, along a line stretching from Inugai, Truri, and Rice Anchorage. Meanwhile, after the victory during the Battle of Kolombangara, Admiral Samajima formed a new night battle unit consisting of the heavy cruisers Kumano, Suzuya, and Chokai, light cruisers Sendai, and destroyers Yugiri, Kiyonami, Yukikaze, and Hamakaze, led by Admiral Nishimura. Their unit was given the task of harassing American transport efforts. Rear Admiral Ijin Matsuji was now commanding the reinforcement unit, who were going to make a run on the 17th. But this was greatly hampered by American airstrikes against Buin. On the 17th, 7 B-24s, 32 P-38s and P-40s, 37 Dauntless, 36 Avengers, and 64 Wildcats and Corsairs hit Buin. 48 Zeros began to take off from Kahili, but they could not scramble fast enough as the Americans bombed the shipping, setting a cargo ship on fire before Hatsuyuki could take a direct hit to her forward magazine, sinking her, and 3 other destroyers were damaged. 13 Zeros were shot down, while the Americans only lost 6 aircraft. Many of Ijun's transports received some minor damage, delaying his departure. On July the 19th, Nishimura attempted a reinforcement run to New Georgia, but his force was intercepted northwest of Kolombangara by a pack of Avengers. Nishimura's ships scattered at high speed upon seeing the enemy aircraft, but Yugeri was successfully torpedoed and sank as a result. The Kiyonami stuck behind to grab some survivors. Meanwhile, cruisers Chokai and Kumano were also heavily damaged. The Kiyonami was later attacked by some B-25s who bombed her at masthead level, leaving her dead in the water. The B-25s also attacked the transports, doing some minor damage to the Matsuzuki and the Minazuki. 582 men, 102 tons of supplies, and 60 drums of fuel were successfully delivered. But the terrible losses led to the newly formed night battle unit to be canned. On the 22nd, another reinforcement convoy consisting of the seaplane tender Nishin and destroyers Arashi, Izokaze, and Hagikaze made a run to Bougainville, led by Rear Admiral Isugi Morikazu. They were carrying 630 men of the South Sea's 4th Guard Unit, 22 tanks, and 8 artillery pieces. They were intercepted by a huge force consisting of 12 B-24s, 16 Dauntless, 18 Avengers, escorted by 134 fighters flown by the US Army, Marines, and New Zealanders. The Nisshin was devastated by bombs, torpedoes, and strafing attacks, leading her to sink within 14 minutes from the start of the interception. Of her 633 crewmen and 630 troops on board, only 178 would be rescued later on by destroyers who faced considerable attacks from aircraft in doing so. Despite the rather insane levels of Allied aircraft attacks, General Imamura continued to commit more forces to the defense of the Central Solomons, now assigning the elite 2nd Battalion 230 Regiment Yano Battalion, led by Lieutenant Colonel Yano Keiji, to reinforce Villa. They were sent aboard destroyers Yukikaze, Mikazuki, and Hamakaze on the night of the 23rd. Instead of sailing through the slot, they used the Wilson Strait, which was very fortunate as Admiral Merrill was coming up the slot with a large task force to supply Liver's Edge at the Inugai Inlet. So at least one poor Japanese transport effort dodged a bullet. I would like to take this time to remind all of you that this podcast is only made possible through the efforts of Kings and Generals over at YouTube. Please go subscribe to Kings and Generals over at YouTube and continue to help us produce this content by checking out www.patreon.com/kingsandgenerals. And hey, don't forget about our sister podcast over at The Age of Conquest, the Fall and Rise of China podcast, written and narrated by me. And hey, if after all that you were still hungry for some more history, why don't you check out my personal channel, the Pacific War Channel, over at YouTube. And I do have a personal request. I have recently unleashed some podcasts featuring interviews with Dave of the Cold War Channel, Cody of Alternate History Hub, and Nitin of Flashpoint History. Please check out those episodes. I'd like to build up a podcast presence on YouTube. Though I will note, you can catch those episodes also on Spotify at the Pacific War Channel podcast. Also, just a reminder, I do have a Patreon account where you can get early access to all of my content and access to the exclusive podcasts over there, like my four-part series on General Kanji Ishiwara, or my little piece on comparing the Opium War of the 19th centuries to the current fentanyl crisis in North America. Please check it out, it'll mean a lot to me. The American drive upon Munda was seeing significant delays as the Japanese proved themselves very capable at defense, especially when they're in pillboxes. However, the battles to reinforce New Georgia were costing the Japanese defeats or Pyrrhic victories.